We come now to our final study, Job and God, chapter 38 through to chapter 42. Can you remember back to chapter 13 where Job had challenged God? Job had challenged God to a contest, and he said something like this: I'd like to come and talk with you and have a contest and have this matter thrashed out. I just ask two things, God. One, when I come into your presence, don't overpower me with your greatness. And also, he says, take away my suffering so that at least I am in a fit physical state to be able to present my case. Now, they're the only two things I ask. And then he says, when I do come before you, you call and I will answer, and then let me speak, and then you reply to me. And so we'll have it out, and you ask me any questions you want me to answer, and I'll answer you, and then I'll ask you questions and you answer me. So we'll meet on an even basis and we'll sort this matter out. God has to tell Job now that Job really had a gross misunderstanding of the nature of God if he thought he could come and talk with God on that sort of basis. So we find now that Job is answered by God. The storm has broken. We saw the build-up in the previous chapter, chapter 37, when Elihu referred to it. And out of the wind and the rain and the thunder and the lightning, God speaks in verse 1. And he says in verse 2, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? That's what he has to say about Job. Job, are you the one that darkens counsel by all this worthless speech? Gird up your loins like a man, verse 3. I will question you, and you shall declare to me. And that's it, says God. I'm not answerable to you. You're answerable to me. Now, I'm going to question you, and you answer me. Never mind about you asking me and thinking that I've got to answer your questions. I'm God, says God, and you're Job. And so God puts a few questions to Job, and they're questions that Job can't answer, because God wants to show Job how little he knows of the workings of the Almighty God. For example, in creation, verse 4, where were you, says God, when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Come on, Job, you've got all the answers. Surely you must know these things. Who stretched the line upon the sea? Where were you when its bases were sunk? Who laid the foundation on the cornerstones? And so he goes on verse after verse. Verse 12, for example. Have you commanded the morning since your days began? Have you caused the dawn to know its place? Do you know how to control the sun, he says to Job? Do you know how to control the sea? Do you know how to control the weather? Well, you should, he says, if you have such great knowledge. Verse 16. Have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have you ever been to the bottom of the ocean to tell us what's there? Verse 21. You ought to know this, Job, says God, because you were born then, weren't you? And there's a great irony in the voice of God as he lays it on the line for Job. And of course, poor old Job has to melt as this withering attack is made on him. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, in verse 22? Have you seen the storehouses of the hail? Can you control the weather, Job? Can you control the snow, the rain, the sun? Can you do all these things, verse after verse after verse? 31, for example, can you control the stars? Verse 34, can you lift up your voice to the clouds that a flood of waters may cover you? Can you control these things, Job, says God? And then from the natural world, God goes to the animal world just to mount the attack against Job. All the things spoken of so far, wind and rain and weather and snow and stars and sea and sky, all of these things from the natural creation, and Job isn't within any distance of doing any one of these things. But God keeps on unrelenting. He turns to the animal world and he points out all sorts of things in the animal world that man doesn't understand, but they're all part of God's ordering of the world. Now, this is what God's building up to. He's getting across to Job the point that there are all sorts of things that happen in God's ordering of the world that man has no way of understanding. Now, see, Job's big problem is that he wants to understand why he is suffering. And so God starts with the inanimate world. Then he moves through the animal world. Then he moves into the moral order of the world. And with blow after blow, God is telling Job in no uncertain terms that there are so many things that man simply doesn't have the capacity to understand. God understands, and all of these things that are happening in the world, in the physical world, in the animal world, all of these things that are happening, God knows why they're happening. God is ordering this world. And man sometimes will look at those things and he'll say to himself, I don't know why that happens. It looks odd to me that such a thing should happen. But yet, says God, I know what I'm doing, even if you don't. For example, he refers to the ostrich. The ostrich that lays its eggs and then it appears to run away and leave them unprotected so that some animal will walk along and tread on them and break them. And you think, well, that's an odd thing to happen. And yet, says God, I still look after the ostrich and its eggs because I have an instinct that I put into animals and they do different things. Take the ox, for example. There's a wild ox and you can't do anything with it. But then there's a tame ox and you can make it plow. There are animals that you can tame and there are animals you can't tame. And I've made it that way. I put certain instincts in animals. Now, you don't know why it is that these animals are so different. Eagles and hawks have eyesight. And from miles up in the air, it seems, they can see the tiniest specks on the ground. And yet there are other animals, like bats, that can hardly see anything. Now, you don't know why this happens, but I do, says God, because that's all part of my world. And man will never know all the ins and outs of the divine ordering of life on this planet. So, Job, says God, realize that there are some things to which you will never know the answer. And so he goes on through chapter 39, and that's the general drift of chapter 39. We'll just pick out a few illustrative sections. For example, verse 5, God gives animals different instincts. For example, the wild ass. Who has let the wild ass go free? Who has loosed the bonds of the swift ass? To whom I have given the steppe for his home and the salt land for his dwelling place? Who controls these migrations and movements and instincts of animals? I do, says God. Verse 9, is the wild ox willing to serve you? Well, of course not, because it hasn't got the instinct to be a working animal. Do you think he'll spend the night at your crib? Can you bind him in the furrow with ropes? Can you make the wild ox work like a tame ox when God has given it quite a different instinct? And then some animals with these puzzling characteristics, such as in verse 13. The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are they the pinions and plumage of love? It would seem that the ostrich doesn't have any love for her young, because in verse 14 she leaves her eggs in the earth and lets them be warmed in the ground, and she forgets that a foot may crush them and the wild beast may trample them. And yet, says God, somehow the ostriches keep on perpetuating their species and I'm looking after them. And then he goes on to talk about a horse, how a horse could be trained for battle and could do mighty things, whereas other animals you can't train them to do anything. Then he talks about the eagles and the hawks with their eyesight and so on, all through the end of the chapter. And then you come to chapter 40, and God now challenges Job to respond with his case. After God has given this outline of the ordering of nature, the Lord said to Job in verse 2 of chapter 40, "Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? Job, you are finding fault with me. Are you in a position really to contend with me? He who argues with God, let him answer it. If you've got anything to say, Job, let's hear it." And just notice something, we're going to notice this increasingly as it moves on, that God has not explained Job's suffering. He hasn't even dealt with the matter of Job's suffering. He hasn't dealt with the problem of Job's intellectual difficulty, why an innocent person suffers. He hasn't confirmed or denied the theories of Job or the theories of his friends. He hasn't said anything about Job's friends. He hasn't even discussed the issue that Job and his friends were debating. Now, God, at the same time, has said nothing against Job in the sense that the three friends did. God has said nothing against Job in the sense that Job was suffering because of sin. But what he has shown is that man cannot expect to understand all the activity of God in a complex world. Now that is what God is saying. Man cannot expect to understand all the activity of God in this very complex world in which we live. He then moves on to increase the pressure on Job in chapter 40. After God has issued the challenge in verse 2, Job apparently has nothing to say. Well, he does have something to say, yes, in verse 3. And what he says is that he is sorry for his rash words. He only says a short amount there in two verses. That's all Job has to say. He doesn't defend himself. He doesn't go back and want to argue with God. All he says is in verse 4, "Behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer thee? I lay my hand upon my mouth. I've spoken once, and I will not answer. Twice, but I will proceed no further. I've already said more than enough," said Job. "I'll keep my hand in my mouth. I'll stuff a handkerchief down my throat. I'll do anything. I just can't really argue any longer." He is completely stunned by the answer that God has given, even though God has not addressed the particular problem that Job and his friends were arguing over, namely, whether suffering is the result of sin or not. But God isn't finished with Job yet. The Lord chastens those whom he loves, and he's giving Job a good amount of big stick here. So he goes on in verse 6. "Does Job still want to put God in the wrong simply to prove himself right?" In verse 7, God says to Job, "Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you declare to me." That's the second time God said that to Job. "Will you even put me in the wrong?" Verse 8. "Will you condemn me so that you may be justified? Have you an arm like God? Can you thunder with a voice like his?" And so the Lord is challenging Job. Does he want to put God in the wrong simply to prove himself right? Well, says God to Job, "If you want to put yourself in the place of the Almighty and judge the moral order of the universe and decide what is right and what is wrong and who suffers and who doesn't and how things are going to work out in human life, if you want to do all those things, then I invite you to take your seat here on the throne and see how clever you are at governing the moral order of the universe. Deck yourself with majesty," verse 10, says God. "Deck yourself with dignity. Clothe yourself with glory and splendor. Put on the purple robes, the crown on your head, and come and sit on the throne of sovereignty. Pour forth the overflowings of your anger. Look on everyone that is proud and abase him. Carry out the work of the divine judge. Come on, Job, let us see how good you are. And when you've done that," says God to Job in verse 14, "then I will acknowledge to you that your own right hand can give you victory." When you can judge the moral order of the world and decide what's what, and declare what is right and what is wrong, and order the whole thing according to what you want, then I will acknowledge that your assessment of yourself is correct. We all deceive ourselves frightfully. We are all a bit like Job, in that we don't really have an unbiased assessment of ourselves. Now, it may have been true that Job was not the great sinner that he was. He certainly was a righteous man. He hadn't suffered because of any sins that he had done. But he, at the same time, was not thereby exonerated. I'm reminded of the words of Paul, who said, "I'm not aware of anything against myself, but I'm not thereby acquitted. It's the Lord who judges me," and that's what Job is now finding out. He doesn't know anything against himself. Job doesn't know what he's done wrong, but he's not thereby acquitted. It's the Lord who judges him. And therefore, neither Job nor you nor I should pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes, because he will then bring to light the things now hidden in darkness, and he will disclose the purposes of the heart. And that is what God is now saying to Job. "When you are able, Job, to carry out the sort of judgment that is my prerogative, then I will accept that your assessment of yourself is valid. But until you can do that, you must realize, Job, that you are not really in an unbiased position to assess yourself. And neither am I, and neither are you. We're all a bit prejudiced towards ourselves." And God has to show Job, as he sometimes has to show us, that we still need to learn a thing or two about his ordering of things. And then from chapter 40, verse 15, right through to the end of chapter 41, we have what I would call a very humorous section. So far from Job being able to govern the moral order of the universe, God now tells him that he's not even in a position to govern the natural, physical order of the universe. And it's much easier to govern the physical creation than it is to govern the moral order of the universe. And God now rams the point home to Job that he is not even able to order anything in this creation. And so God goes to a couple of animals. And the first one is in the latter half of chapter 40, and it's called in verse 15, Behemoth, which in the margin will probably say hippopotamus. And that certainly appears to be what he's talking about. It was probably the biggest animal that was known in the region where Job lived. And God refers to the hippopotamus and points out what a mammoth of an animal it is. He describes it in very colourful language through to the end of the chapter, saying to Job, can you govern this animal? Can you control even one single animal, such as the hippopotamus? Can you make it submit to the things you want it to do? Can you implant an instinct within it to make it do things in the water, on the land? He says, look, Job, you are not in the hunt of doing anything. He describes it there, and verse 22 will just show a reference there to the fact that his shade is the lotus trees. The lotus trees cover him, the willows of the brook surround him, and if the river is turbulent, he's not frightened. He's a tough character, is the hippo, and he's not even frightened of a rough river, and of course he lives around under the trees on the riverbank. But the really amusing one is in chapter 41, where God refers now to the crocodile. Well, that's what it appears to be. It's called Leviathan. Perhaps it's some sea monster, but I think, again, most commentators and most versions consider it to be the crocodile. Another one of God's unusual animals. I remember reading a book by H.L. Ellison on the book of Job. In fact, it's a very good book. If you want to read something to follow up these studies, that's a book I'd recommend. It's called From Tragedy to Triumph by H.L. Ellison, published by Paternoster Press. It doesn't follow the same development of the book that I'm doing, although the interpretation is the same, but it's a different approach to the book as he deals with the different characters and just touches on some of the main themes of the book. It's a very stimulating book. On this particular passage, Ellison refers to God's jokes, and he points out something of the humour of God, and he says if you think that God doesn't have a sense of humour, then you ought to take a wander around a zoo one day and see some of the odd things there. And as you look at these animals, he again says that here we can see something of the handiwork of God in these strange creatures. Well, certainly in the description here, there is quite a bit of humour built into chapter 41 as God describes the crocodile for Job. He says, for example, in verse 1, can you draw out Leviathan, the crocodile, with a fish hook? Imagine a little boy going to fish and he's got a piece of string with a hook on the end. He comes home and Mum says, what did you catch? And he says, I caught a 20-foot crocodile. He says, can you draw out a crocodile with a fish hook? Verse 3, he says, will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak to you soft words? Like a bird in a cage, cheepy cheepy, give a coffee, a cup of tea or something. He says, do you think the crocodile is going to speak gently to you? Verse 5, he says, can you play with him as with a bird? Or can you put him on a leash for your maidens? Imagine a couple of the nice young ladies going down the street with some little poodle pups on a string and trotting down through the marketplace. He says, could you do that with a crocodile? How about today we take our crocodiles out for a walk, and so the two lovely maidens grab their two 20-foot crocodiles and take them for a walk through the main street on a leash. He says, can you do that to him? Verse 8, he says, can you lay hands on him? Stroke him as if you're stroking a cat? Think of the battle. You won't do it again. Not exactly the sort of animal to fool around with. And God is telling Job, see, Job, there's even that one animal, the crocodile. He says in verse 10, no one is so fierce that he dares to stir him up. Who then is he that can stand before me? So the first 10 verses paint this picture of the crocodile as being a very fearsome creature that you obviously don't keep as a pet in your living room. Nobody, he said in his right mind, would stir up the crocodile. You wouldn't go and start poking sticks in his eyes and thinking that you're going to have a little game with him. And yet he says to Job, you would stir me up by the things you've said against me. You wouldn't dare stir up a crocodile, but you think you can stand up to God. That's the challenge in verse 10. And then God reverts in the following verses to his description of this very fearsome creature. For example, verse 13. Who can strip off his outer garment? Who can penetrate his double coat of mail, his tough outer skin? Who can open the doors of his face, the great jaws of the animal that are so strong? He says, this animal is so tough that he's frightened of nothing. For example, verse 25, when he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid. They are beside themselves. As he pictures this animal thrashing around in the water, its great tail banging around the place, and everybody is scared when they see an animal like this. And in verse 26, he says, even though the sword reach him, it does not avail. Even the spear, the dart, the javelin, it's just like a pinprick. You try to throw one of those things into his skin and it just bounces off. He just sort of scratches himself and thinks the mozzies are bad or something like that. He said, look, he's so tough in verse 27 that he counts iron as straw. And so he goes on through the rest of the chapter. And you think to yourself, what a terribly odd way of answering Job's problem. What on earth has a crocodile and a hippopotamus got to do with Job sitting out there in the garbage dump scratching himself because of his dire affliction? God certainly works in strange ways his wonders to perform, and very often he answers us in ways that we don't expect. And again, God has still said nothing specific about Job's problem, and Job still has no answer to his questions. His intellectual problems have not been answered. He doesn't know why it was that he suffered. And yet God has dealt with him in such a way that Job is satisfied. He now realizes, through these illustrations that God has thrown at him, he now realizes that God is above all, God is in control of all, God can do things that he is not within the hunt of doing, God knows things that Job has no understanding of at all, God orders the whole of the physical creation, and Job can't order anything. Who then is he to challenge the wisdom and the might and the power of God? And those two long chapters about all the creation and the animals, those things have made Job realize that even in the smallest detail, God knows what he is doing. Even all those bits and pieces about the claws of the animal and the scales on the skin of a crocodile, and verse after verse talking about his teeth and his jaws and all those things. No detail escapes the attention of the Almighty. That's the message that's coming through. And that's why God has spent 34 verses just talking about a crocodile. There's more about the crocodile here in one chapter of Job than you get about some great doctrines in the New Testament. More here than about the Lord's Supper. More in this one chapter about a crocodile than about the doctrine of baptism in Romans and things like that. But you see, God is using this as his way of telling Job that he does know what he's doing. God does know what he's doing. And even when Job doesn't know the answer, at least he knows that this one can be trusted. And if he can take note of even the smallest detail and arrange in every one of his creatures in this universe, can arrange all the smallest details in their lives and their instincts and their habits, well then Job's plight hasn't escaped God's notice. And Job now feels that this one is so totally in control of everything, he knows everything down to the minutest detail, that he is worthy indeed of man's trust. And so Job answers in chapter 42, and he says, I know that you can do everything. I know that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. And that's the realization that Job has come to. He still doesn't know why he suffered, but he knows that God knows. And that's the important thing. And Job is satisfied with that. He knows that God's purposes are perfect. Now, Job may not know those purposes, but at least he's satisfied now that even if he doesn't know those purposes, at least God does. And he's quite confident that those purposes are perfect, even though he himself is in the dark as to what those purposes are. No purpose of yours can be thwarted. I know that you know everything and you can do everything. And then he quotes God's words concerning his own stupid, rash statements previously. God had said, "Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge?" And Job says, "Me. I'm the one." He owns up here in verse 3, "I have uttered what I did not understand. Things too wonderful for me, things I didn't know." And he admits that God's accusation was correct. "I have hidden counsel without knowledge. I have uttered what I did not understand. But now I admit it all," he says, "and I realize that I would have been better to have kept my mouth closed." And then he quotes again God's words in verse 4, where God had challenged Job on two occasions by saying, "Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you declare to me." That's what God had said to Job. And Job says now in verse 5, "I had heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees thee." He no longer questions God. God has questioned him, and Job has been dumbstruck. He's got no answer to God. God is sovereign, God is supreme. But he has at least met God. And the one thing Job always wanted, right through the book, he says, "I want to meet God." And now he has met him. And with that meeting, he is satisfied. Previously, he says in verse 5, "Previously I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear. I had a theoretical knowledge of you. But now," he says, "I've met you." And that's the difference. Those friends of his also had a theoretical knowledge of God. And they could spout all their wisdom too. And Job could argue with them, and Job could spout his wisdom. But the difference is that those men had never the experience that Job had had, and they certainly don't have this experience. And that's what has changed Job now. He has met God, and therefore in verse 6, "I despise myself, and I repent in dust and ashes." He still has no answer to his problem. He still doesn't know the reason why he suffered. But he is satisfied. Why is he satisfied? He is satisfied because he has met God. And he has a fuller knowledge of God. And he realizes now that God is not answerable to man. And if that's the only thing we learn, then we've learned something very, very important. We don't have God on a string. We can't question God as if he's there to do our bidding, as if he's there to come running whenever we shake the bell, as if he's some sort of jack-in-the-box there to jump up whenever we press the button. God is not answerable to us. God is supreme. That's what God is telling Job. "I am the Lord," says God to Job. "But you can trust me. I don't promise that I'm going to give you a reason for everything that happens in life. But I am telling you that I am the Lord. And I do know what's going on. And I can be trusted." And that's what Job has now found. The Lord is known to him. He understands him better. He ceases arguing. He no longer challenges God, but he casts himself entirely upon God. He really does know God, and he trusts God. And that's the sort of faith that you and I have got to have. We've got to develop. And too often, we want to know why. And God has never promised that he's going to give us an answer to every one of our questions, because God is not answerable to us. But we are answerable to him. Job has been conquered. He's repented in dust and ashes. And yet at the same time, he's at peace. He's at peace now. He's no longer wrestling with God, fighting and challenging and spitting and screaming and stamping. He's at peace. He is conquered. He has been conquered. "Take my yoke upon you," said Jesus, "and learn of me. I am meek and lowly of heart, and you'll find rest for your soul." Find rest for your soul through submitting to the Lordship of God. And he realizes now that God is greater than anything he ever imagined. No longer does he make demands. He simply falls down and worships. Well, what of the friends? Well, the three friends, in spite of all the theoretical truths which were mixed in with all their statements, the three friends are now declared wrong. And Job, in spite of all the rash words mixed in with his statements, is now declared right. Job had not been the great sinner that they had accused him of being. In accusing Job of great sin, his friends had not spoken the truth. In asserting his own innocence of the accusations made against him, Job had spoken the truth. And so God at least makes that much clear. But he still doesn't say why Job suffered. But he does vindicate Job. And he points out that all the accusations made against him were false, and that Job has indeed been upright. So that's what he says in verse 7. After the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz, who was the senior of the three men, "My wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. Now therefore take 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering. And my servant Job shall pray for you, for I will accept his prayer, not to deal with you according to your folly. For you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has." And at the end of verse 9 we find the Lord accepted Job's prayer. So there's no vindictiveness in Job. And when God had every right to punish those three friends severely for their heartlessness, for their falsehood, for their lack of sympathy with Job, God had every right to punish them for their folly, we find that Job prayed for them. And that again is what we're taught in the Bible, to pray for our enemies, to pray for those who despitefully use us, those who make false accusations, to pray for them. And now Job does pray for them, and the Lord hears Job's prayer, and the Lord does not punish these men, but of course they have to make offerings for their sin. The friends' theory of suffering is therefore proved wrong. Their theory that suffering is always the result of personal wrongdoing, that theory is now proved wrong. Job's desire for God is now satisfied. The friends relied on traditional teaching. Job was the one who searched for the truth. He may have been rash in doing so. We, good, conservative evangelicals, are shocked at some of the things that Job might have said. But yet in the end we find that God is gracious. Job had been searching for the truth, and even though he might have trodden on the corns of the conservatives on his way through, in the end God gives him credit, at least he searched for the truth. But these other three, they weren't searching for anything. They were resting confident in the fact that they had all the theology straight, and this is what they'd been taught, and they just parroted it off without any attempt to relate it to everyday experience, and totally unsympathetic to the plight of their friend. And their traditional theories in the long run got them nowhere except got them God's condemnation. As I said at the beginning, the friends talked about God. Job was the only one who talked to God. And Job wasn't the only one in the Bible who talked rashly when he talked to God. You find Moses on a number of occasions said things that were rash. We find that Jeremiah said things that were rash. We find that Asaph in some of his Psalms says things that are rash. We find that Job says things that are rash. And yet in those cases we find that God is in some way sympathetic to these people, because they are people who are right at heart. They are people who are seeking the truth, who are not content to rest in the pious platitudes of the faithful. They are people who want better answers. And although God may rebuke them and show them in the long run that they didn't really have the answers themselves, at least they were searching for reality, they were searching for truth. And I think we have to be sympathetic to people. Sometimes we get a bit upset when we find a person that's going through some trial and you've got some hassles, and sometimes that person says a few rash things that more orthodox people such as we wouldn't say. And we tend to judge them for that. And I think here is a reminder that we must be very careful. Of course, there are irreverent people that simply want to take the mickey out of God, so to speak, and we must have no truck with that sort of thing, and God shows no tolerance of that sort of thing either. But I think we must be very careful not to do the sorts of things that Job's three friends did, and certainly not to interpret other people's misfortunes the way they did. Not to rest on the pious platitudes, not to rest on all the traditional things which we're going to follow through and ride to the death without any attempt to understand another person's needs and sufferings. Job was the one in the end who met God. He was the one who talked with God. He took his complaints to the right place. And that's something we've got to learn to do. Not to go around spouting all our troubles and woes and doubts and fears to other people and mixing them all up, but if we have those things, to take them direct to God. That's what Job did. And God had to straighten him out, but in the end it was Job who was vindicated and the three friends who were condemned. I doubt if Job ever knew the real reason for his suffering. We, of course, know. We know that it was connected with Satan's accusation. Satan said, take all this man's property away and he'll curse you to your face. Send him suffering and he'll drop his faith like a hot potato. And God says he won't. And Satan therefore tempted Job. And we find that Job didn't drop his faith. And in the end, he was the one that God vindicated. There's nothing here to indicate to us that Job ever understood. But now that Satan has been proved wrong, it's only fair, you might say, that prosperity and happiness should return to Job. Because he hadn't done anything to deserve the loss of his prosperity and happiness. Satan's been proved wrong. Job did stand up in spite of his failings along the way. He did remain true. And therefore we find that God, in verse 10, restored the fortunes of Job after he had prayed for his friends. And the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. And of course it proved to the citizens, in the only language they understood, that God was indeed pleased with Job. And so you read through the remaining verses of the book, and we find that Job increased in sheep, in cattle, in camels, in oxen, and all the other things. He had sons and daughters. He had happiness in his family, prosperity in his farm. He was respected among the citizens. And he died an old man, full of days, contented, prosperous, and in good health. It's a great book. And I hope that as we've looked at it, we've been able to see a few of these lessons. If it drives us to God, then I believe that it has achieved a real purpose. If it makes us cautious, if it teaches us to revise our thinking, if it teaches us a greater trust in God, then I believe that it has been worthwhile reading through all those discourses, tracing through all those arguments, because it brings us to this grand climax when we have this man who has been conquered and yet at the same time found peace. And he's found it in the God whom he served, whom he refused to give up. And through it all, he remained faithful. And in the end, we find that he is rewarded in the only way that people would have understood. Sometimes people look at that ending to the book and they think it's a little bit of a contradiction, because the whole purpose of the book has been to tell us that suffering is not always the result of evil and prosperity is not always the result of good. But at least it shows us that in this case, God decided he would reward Job with prosperity because he remained faithful. And so Job dies in this contented old age, and through all the nastiness of the whole story, it has this good ending. The main feature, the sovereignty of God. He is Lord, he is in control, and we, like Job, have to learn to trust him.